The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
When Nicole Sandler sits down to do her show, she's the producer, booking the guests, pulling the audio, planning the show, the engineer, running the controls, troubleshooting any problems, playing the sounds, calling the guests, and she's the webmaster, writing the blog, posting the podcast, maintaining the website, not to mention the host, interviewing the guests, explaining the issues, giving opinions, and calling out the bad guys, and then you get the Nicole Sandler Show on NicoleSandler.com.
I don't know about you, but I'm exhausted. Man, I feel like Madeline Kahn, Young Frankenstein, or is it Frankenstein? Anyway, welcome to a Tuesday. Before we start, I need to address something I just learned literally moments ago. If you've been listening to this program for any amount of time, over the years, you heard a gentleman named Dennis Campbell. He was over in the UK. In fact, for a while, he published UK Progressive Magazine. He hosted a podcast, The Three Muckrakers. Took me a moment to remember what it was. And actually, Dennis and I had a little bit of a falling out during the last presidential election. Because he was not a Jeremy Corbyn fan. Again, he was over in the UK. And the things that he didn't like about Jeremy Corbyn, he was ascribing to Bernie Sanders. And it got very personal and it got ugly. And for a while there, we stopped talking. I couldn't deal with the things he was saying. And thankfully, some months ago, We spoke. Well, we exchanged emails and cleared the air, and I'm glad we did because I just learned he passed away last night. I know Dennis Campbell was suffering from some form of cancer. That's when we reconnected after he was diagnosed, and I shared with him my cancer diary that I posted on the website. But it's so sad. It's so disconcerting. And these days, it feels like people are dropping like flies, probably because they are. We've got a global pandemic going on that's claimed over, 850,000 lives in the U.S. alone over the last 2 years, and many, many more globally. This was not COVID that killed Dennis Campbell, but cancer. And all I can say is fuck cancer. So let me shake that off. I hate hearing that. Dennis Campbell leaves behind a family over in the UK. It's just sad. On that note, today is sad. It really is. I've spent a good portion of the day watching the so-called debate on voting rights in the Senate. Now, the only reason they were able to open debate is because they used a very rare technicality in Congress where, so that this voting rights package could not, well, opening debate, cloture vote to open debate could not be filibustered because they used a procedure known as the message from the House. It's some weird rule that if a bill is passed back and forth between the two chambers three times, not twice, mind you, but three, not four may it be, but three is the number, three times, then cloture could not be, to open debate, could not be filibustered. Don't ask. So many of the rules of the Senate don't make any sense. So I'm not trying to understand this one, to just tell you that it was. And so Chuck Schumer gets up today, and this is basically how it began.
Democrats have tried for months to hold a voting rights debate on the floor, but we have been blocked each time by Republicans. We brought common sense proposals four times on the floor of the Senate, and only once did one senator, Lisa Murkowski, to her credit, agree to even begin debate on voting rights. On all three other votes, not a single Republican joined us. Every one of them voted to block even a debate on voting rights.
No debate.
So today we are taking this step by using a message from the
House. Message from the House, okay.
Now it's just a step, but an important step moving forward in that we will finally debate this one issue that is so central to the American people, to our history, and to our democracy. As we debate these measures, the Senate will confront a critical question. Shall the members of this chamber do what is necessary to pass these bills and bring them closer to the President's desk? Today, we have just taken the first steps that will put everyone on the record. Now, much has been said over the past few days about the prospects of passing voting rights legislation in this chamber. Senate Democrats are under no illusion that we face difficult odds, especially when virtually every Senate Republican is staunchly against legislation protecting the right to vote. But I want to be clear. When this chamber confronts a question this important, one so vital to our country, so vital to our ideals, so vital to the future of our democracy, you don't slide it off the table and say, never mind. Win, lose, or draw. Members of this chamber were elected to debate and to vote.
Right.
Especially on an issue as vital to the beating heart of our democracy as voting rights.
You think?
And the public is entitled to know where each senator stands on an issue as sacrosanct as defending our democracy. The American people deserve to see their senators go on record on whether they will support these bills or oppose them. Indeed, that may be the only way to make progress on this issue now, for the public to see where each of us in this chamber stands.
So that's what this is about. The debate is not a debate. You know, it's a series of speeches, but it's just dragging on all day. They go for long stretches, minutes. Like many minutes at a time, when they're waiting for another senator to come to the floor. Maria Cantwell of Washington is on her second go-round. Did they not? I know a number of the senators went to, I think, Ukraine and were meeting with the president there, Zelensky, because it's looking like Russia could invade Ukraine at any moment now. So I think there was like five or six senators, a bipartisan group of senators who went over there. Obviously, they're not back today for the debate. There will not be any voting today. The soonest a vote can happen is tomorrow. And what happens is that technicality they use, the message from the House, it eliminated the filibuster to start debate. But they can still filibuster closing debate, ending debate. Now, in any bill, even when they're filibustered, the passage of the bill only takes 51 votes. It's the cloture votes that are filibusterable. So, most of the stuff today, again, it was just so slow moving and didn't get anywhere. But there's one clip I want to play for you. This is Jeff Merkley of Oregon. And listen carefully, because it sounds that what they're edging towards is going back to the talking filibuster.
They have an incentive to negotiate. So you get amendments, you get the public involved,
yeah,
and most important, you recreate an incentive to negotiate. That is the reinvigorated filibuster strategy, the talking filibuster, public filibuster,
or just call it filibuster.
Extended debate on final passage of the bill. Whatever you call it, it is better than the paralysis and partisanship that are destroying the Senate's ability to address the questions that face this nation. And there is no more important question than defending the right of every citizen to vote.
Yeah, right? So they're talking about going back to the talking filibuster. I want to play for you a clip from this program from March. The date was March 9th of last year, March 9th, 2021. My guest was Norm Ornstein, close friend of Al Franken's, and the two of them had written a couple of op-eds, and I had read one that day, but there was another one that was published like a week or two earlier that I was asking him about, because it sounded like this was the solution, and it sounds like today they're headed back in that direction. So let's get in the Wayback Machine, go back to March 9th of last year for Norm Ornstein to explain why the talking filibuster. What's wrong with the way they're doing things now? Well, you know, but why would the talking filibuster fix it? So here's Norm.
I noticed a week or so ago you had an op-ed in the Washington Post that was titled "Democrats Can't Kill the Filibuster, But They Can Gut It." And this is what we're talking about. The filibuster that Joe Manchin, who is probably arguably or not the most conservative Democrat in the Senate, and Kyrsten Sinema, who wants to challenge him for that title, I suppose, both say they are totally opposed to getting rid of the filibuster. What you're saying is, well, we don't have to get rid of it. We can bring it back to its former glory. And in fact, I found a piece that you and Al Franken wrote together for the Star Tribune about a month earlier. And I guess Al talked about it in first person on the process when he was in the Senate, where he should still be, by the way, but that's a story for another day. When they were hit with a bill being filibustered by the other side, and how it seemed that their responsibilities or the way to make the filibuster end rested with the majority and not the minority, and it seems like it should be the other way around. Can you explain what the dilemma is here with the filibuster as it now stands?
Oh, sure. And, you know, Al's observation was that he was on the floor and he said to a Republican colleague, "See you Monday." Mm-hmm. And the Republican colleague said, "Oh, I don't have to be here Monday. It's a cloture vote," meaning a vote to end the talking and move to a vote. "You have to be here. I don't." And it really struck him, something that we had seen for some time. And, you know, just a little bit of history, Nicole. Cloture requirement before 1975 was, going back to 1917, was two-thirds of those senators present and voting necessary to break a filibuster, move to, it actually should be closure, but it's called cloture, and then move on to a vote. They changed it in 1975, and what was widely interpreted as lowering that threshold from two-thirds to three-fifths, but they also changed it to three-fifths of the whole Senate. And that meant you needed 60 votes. Now, if it were a present and voting standard with 60 votes, or three-fifths of the Senate, imagine if only 80% showed up, then you only need 48 votes to get cloture and move on. So under that standard, if you're going to go round the clock, and, you know, some of us are old enough to remember those not so storied days when Strom Thurmond and the segregationists filibustered civil rights bills. The minority had to be there, sleeping on lumpy cots outside the Senate floor, because if a bunch of them didn't show up, then the threshold was lowered. Hmm. If it's three-fifths, period, then it's the majority that has to have 60 members show up. And there, the sort of signature moment was at one point when Democrats had 60 senators and the Affordable Care Act was up and they needed all 60. But Robert Byrd was on his deathbed and they had to drag him out on a gurney, then on a wheelchair to the Senate floor, where Robert Byrd, who was one of the great defenders of the filibuster, took his fist at the Republicans in the Senate and cried out in a rather feeble voice, "Shame, shame, shame." They wouldn't give any leeway to him at all. They played the hardest of hardball. And of course, as Al found out and saw firsthand, the burden is totally on the majority. That flips the idea, the sort of halcyon days, which never really existed, but that Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema talk about, where the minority had the burden and where you could actually have real debate because you'd go round the clock and you could be on the floor debating it, and where in a different time when you actually had norms of wanting to govern, it was an incentive to try and build a supermajority. What Mitch McConnell has done is to destroy all of that and exploit the rule as a weapon of mass obstruction. If you don't have any burden on you, you can filibuster as they did for all the time in the Obama administration, every nominee for an executive post or a judgeship, and soak up a tremendous amount of precious floor time. You can take minor bills. And if you filibuster something under the rules, you basically just have to deny unanimous consent to move forward. And then you have to jump through hoops. You can file a cloture petition, which means that you'll try and get the 60 votes to overcome it. It takes 2 days for that to, as they say, ripen. Then you've got all this time with all these different votes. And if you finally succeed in getting that cloture, there were 30 hours of post-cloture debate. And what the Republicans did was to use the full time, even if they weren't debating. So there are ways to get rid of that and to put the burden where it belongs on the minority. And that's what Al and I have been talking about.
So that Norm Ornstein on this show back in March of last year, talking about this subject, the burning question is, why does it take until January 18th of the next year to get to this? That's what I'm angry about today. Not the fact that they're doing it, but that they waited so long. Joe Biden gave this wonderful speech the other day, but I think it was too little too late. So anyway, that's what's going on there. Tomorrow will be a vote, and it looks like it'll go down because Manch Enema, that's why. So well, to be continued tomorrow. We do have a guest coming up today. And if you watch cable TV at all, you've seen that this book is being talked about a lot. It's just out today. It's called Davos Man, How the Billionaires Devoured the World. And we'll speak to the author, Peter S. Goodman, in about 10 minutes or so when he joins us at the bottom of the hour. It's fascinating. Davos kicked off yesterday, but virtually because of COVID. So I'm not going to waste any time here. We'll do it all with Peter. But what I do want to tell you is, so yesterday, you know, we were talking about Martin Luther King Day, it was, and I played for you something from Yolanda King, the granddaughter of Martin and Coretta Scott King. And she was brilliant. And I misremembered it. I got it wrong. I said we first heard her speak when she was like five or something at the Women's March. Well, it wasn't the Women's March. It was the March for Our Lives. That was the Parkland kids, the group they organized. And in fact, they're back in D.C. But I dug out, if I can find it, is it here? Yes. No, that's not it. Hold on. I do have it here somewhere. There it is. So I dug out the video from the March for Our Lives. This was 2018. 2020. So this is like 4 years ago. I believe she was 9 years old. She's 13 now. So not five, but nine. Anyway, this was, again, from the... that's the wrong one I have up there. This, I know I'm going to just pull it down here. Sorry, you're hearing all my my talking to myself as I get the shot right. Okay, so from the March for Our Lives in 2018, check out the granddaughter of Martin Luther King Jr. This girl is the future.
Martin Luther King and Coretta Scott King. My grandfather had a dream that his four little children will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream that enough is enough.
Yeah.
Period.
Yeah. I'll go with that.
Will you please repeat these words after me? Spread the word.
Spread the word.
Have you heard?
Have you heard?
All across the nation.
All across the nation.
We
are going to be
a great generation.
A
Redeem it! Read the words!
Read the words!
Have you heard? All across the nation!
We
are going to be
a great generation!
And I'd like you to say it like you really, really mean it!
Nine years old. Awesome, is she, right? So that was from what, like 5 years ago? Well, she spoke yesterday. There was another march on Washington, and Yolanda Renee King got up and spoke again, and now she's 13. Check her out. Check this out.
The elected leaders out there who are tweeting, posting, and celebrating my grandfather, Dr. King, today... My message to you is simple. Do not celebrate. Legislate. The Senate must do the right thing when this legislation comes to a vote tomorrow. Senator Sinema, Senator Manchin,
yeah.
Our future hinges on your decision, and history will remember what choice you make.
Yolanda Renee King. You know, Martin Luther King III... is not a great speaker. But Yolanda? Oh, she's got it going on. She is the few. Watch this young girl. She's a girl now. She's soon to be a woman. Watch out for her because she's amazing. So on that note, though, well, there was a little bit of a disconnect. A lot of outlets yesterday pointed out that it seems... that Republicans know one and only one Martin Luther King quote. Here's Joe Biden explaining sort of the problem.
On this federal holiday that honors him, it's not just enough to praise him.
No.
We must commit to his unfinished work to deliver jobs and justice, to protect the sacred right to vote, the right from which all other rights flow.
Okay, so that's Joe Biden with a nod to King. Youngkin, the new governor of Virginia, actually had the gall to use this Martin Luther King Jr. quote while defending his ban of critical race theory in Virginia schools.
School system. We're not going to teach our children to view everything through a lens of race. Yes, we will teach all history, the good and the bad. Because we can't know where we're going unless we know where we have come from. But to actually teach our children that one group is advantaged and another is disadvantaged simply because of the color of their skin cuts across everything we know to be true.
Oh, my God.
And the immortal words of Dr. Martin Luther King ring in our ears that we must judge one another by the content of our character and not the color of our skin. But this is what will be the founding principle of our executive order, what we're going to do in Virginia schools.
This is called missing the point. But Youngkin is not the only one. Check this out.
Critical race theory is a Marxist doctrine that rejects the vision of Martin Luther King Jr.
Martin Luther King was a great teacher in Martin Luther King Jr.'s dream of having a colorless society.
He wanted his children to be judged by the content of their character.
And not by the color of their skin.
People are judged by the content of their character.
And not the color of their skin.
He didn't want people judged on the color of their skin, but on the content of their character.
Content of their character, not by the color of their skin.
We must judge one another by the content of our character, not the color of our skin.
Wow. It's like that's the only quote that they know. And they're missing the point. That was his dream. It is not yet a reality. Sadly, people are judged by on the color of their skin. Content of their character is an afterthought in most cases. That's not how we should be operating. And these Republicans who all insisted on, you know, invoking King, while making excuses for banning critical race theory from the schools, says all you need to hear. I just want to ask one of them, please explain, when you say you want to ban critical race theory from the schools, what you are talking about. Because I don't think any of them knows. I don't think any of them understands that critical race theory is not taught in primary or high school. It's not taught in the schools. It's like a graduate level college course. I guess if you study law, it's just not part of the curriculum, but they're all glomming onto it. And the fact that they're invoking that and trying to make excuses for, banning critical race theory while quoting Martin Luther King, it would be laughable if it weren't so really sad, but it is sad. Anyway, all right, we're going to move on. I told you we had a guest coming up today. I also told you that yesterday was the day that the Davos World Economic Forum was to have kicked off, but it's virtual. It did kick off, but virtually. There's not, it's not the parking lot of private jets, you know, in Switzerland that usually happens around these Davos World Forums. It is a virtual happening, but it is happening nonetheless. And it coincides with the release today of the book Davos Man, How the Billionaires Devoured the World. And joining us, I'm honored, Peter S. Goodman is our guest today, the day the book is released. Peter, thank you so much for joining us today, and congratulations on the book.
Thanks for having me.
On the release date. Davos Man, is that like a new classification, sort of like Neanderthal or Cro-Magnon Man or Florida Man, perhaps?
Yeah, right. Well, I think we need a taxonomy. I mean, Davos Man is this term that goes back to 2004 when the political scientist Samuel Huntington used it to refer to people who go to the World Economic Forum in Davos. You know, that's this ultimate gathering of powerful people, heads of state, billionaires, tycoons of every stripe. But it's really come to mean people who are so powerful and so wealthy that they write the rules for the rest of us. Their wealth spreads across jurisdictions. They have accountants in multiple countries. They don't feel any particular allegiance to anyone or anything except for the bottom line. And here's the punchline. They're asking us increasingly for adulation for saving the world. I mean, this is literally what Mark Benioff, who's on the board of trustees of the forum, said last year during a virtual meeting of the World Economic Forum. They couldn't meet in Davos. He said, CEOs are the heroes of the pandemic. The government didn't save us. We saved you. We gave you vaccines and emergency lending programs, and you're welcome, basically.
Oh, my.
Yeah, I mean, it's really astonishing. You know, you think about the robber barons who were content to just own everything. And, okay, here's a Carnegie Hall here and there. Here's a university block of classrooms. We'll stick our name on there. You're welcome. We'll forget about the fact that there was a lot of brutalizing of labor, a lot of crushing of dissent. They were happy to be rich. The Davos Man is playing for the whole thing. Davos Man wants to replace government, wants to replace really all institutions and set up a world in which we're supposed to just be grateful that we have anything.
Yeah, and some of us are fighting back. I mean, those of us who supported Bernie Sanders through one or two presidential campaigns knew about how the billionaires were gaining a larger and larger share of the planet's wealth. And just today, or maybe yesterday, but it just released by Oxfam, a new study that shows that, I think it's called, what I have the actual PDF pulled up here, Inequality Kills. And it shows that the 10 richest people in the world, who all happen to be white men, by the way, more than doubled their wealth from a collective $700 billion to $1.5 trillion during the pandemic. I mean, you read something, but they're saying, oh, they're the ones who make things possible for us. They're the ones who are pushing this inequality. They're getting wealthier and wealthier while the rest of us are falling deeper and deeper into poverty, it seems.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really important point. You know, I mean, we now live in an age where the wealthiest people, I mean, take Jeff Bezos, mm-hmm. you know, take Richard Branson. They're wealthy enough that they can literally blast themselves into space and enjoy the view of the Earth from up there in the cosmos where everything must look pretty perfect. And, you know, one can say the problem is not that Jeff Bezos is wealthy enough to blast himself into space and spend $5 billion on a space mission, which, you know, is enough money to have vaccinated the world, you know, many times over, even while we're paying the monopoly patent rates for the vaccines we've got. It's not that he has gained enough to do this while people in his warehouses are, you know, laboring in the middle of a pandemic without PPE. It's because those people are working in those circumstances. I mean, his business model, Amazon's e-commerce empire, depends on there being enough desperate people willing to work in horrifying conditions that most people would just simply reject if they had an alternative, as a way of keeping costs low, as a way of returning more to his shareholders. And this is a very successful operation. For, you know, consumers enjoy it. It's very convenient. It's not an accident that we've given so much of our business to Amazon. Uh-huh. And Bezos enjoys it. But the result of this is that we've got increasing numbers of people in truly desperate circumstances. We've got small businesses that can't compete. We've got warehouse workers who don't earn enough to consume. And the whole system has been revealed as unstable. It's been breaking down during the pandemic.
Exactly. But this is the reality we're living under. And so, Peter S. Goodman, I want to give your credentials. Why did you write this book, Davos Man? And you are the global economics correspondent for the New York Times. You've been covering this kind of stuff forever. But what made you decide to write specifically about Davos and the billionaires who gather there every year?
Well, I've been going to Davos on and off for 10 years, and it's an experience that's left me often with kind of a queasy feeling. I mean, on the one hand, it's exciting to be in a room full of heads of state, full of the wealthiest people on earth, people who actually do know an awful lot about things that any reporter wants to know about. Mm-hmm. They do understand how the world operates because they're writing the rules under which the world is operating. So it's kind of intoxicating, and yet the artifice is just, I mean, the whole charade of it is incredible. You know, I mean, you can watch billionaires go to simulations of the Syrian refugee experience. They're being led around in the dark while people are screaming at them in languages they don't understand, demanding papers. And they're emerging, talking about their great empathy for the refugees. And then they go off, you know, to dinners thrown by giant consulting companies, giant banks, where they're serving truffles and white asparagus and glasses of champagne. I mean, the whole that just on that level, that's pretty hard to take.
Right.
But the thing that's sort of hardest to take is, you know, the mantra of the forum is committed to improving the state of the world.
Right.
So there's a tacit understanding that everyone present is committed to improving the state of the world. So you can go, for instance, to panels full of pharmaceutical industry CEOs about the unaffordability of drugs. And there's this process, you know, of, well, let's puzzle over this. You know, well, what is it? You know, could it be that we haven't found the right model? You know, do we not understand consumer behavior? It's everything except for, well, the people actually gathered around the table engaging in the charade have decided to exploit their monopoly power and privatize the gains of publicly financed research while they're jacking up drugs so that most people can't afford them. But you can't say that. That's like impolite. That goes against the grain of Davos, where everyone just agrees that just by simply being there, you're virtuous. Now, from a distance, we all may say, you know, we can all see through that. That's just a bunch of PR, virtue signaling. But I think for the people who actually go to Davos, it's this very powerful experience of bonding, of feeling that they, by dint of being there, maybe attending a session on gender inequality, on racism, on greater transparency and governance. You know, Sheryl Sandberg 1 year led a whole session on, you know, how to make the web, you know, a greater source of human progress. I mean, this is the kind of stuff that we experience. I think they leave feeling this kind of smug sense of being the good people. And that empowers them to go home and continue to fight to maintain their privileges and fend off any attempts to redistribute wealth. So I, you know, I had done this for 10 years and I had learned stuff that wasn't necessarily making it into my stories, you know, not because there's any sort of secret conspiracy to censor, but because, you know, I'm there to write about particular subjects. But after 10 years, I thought, well, there's actually one big truth to all of this. This is like the kind of dark matter that explains a lot of the things I was writing about. I was writing about Brexit. I was writing about the rise of Trump, the rise of nativist, anti-globalization, often very racist political movements that were sweeping the globe. And what I came to see time and again was that the missing element was always this kind of pillaging by the billionaire class. So, you know, on the surface, we'd write about, you know, why are Italians embracing far right parties that are demonizing immigrants? Why is Sweden, the supposed bastion of social democracy, elevating the Sweden Democrats, a party with actual roots in the neo-Nazi movement, to the third, you know, to a mainstream party status? Well, beneath all of these stories, and I think this applies to Trump, I think it applies to Brexit, is the story of a systematic bottom-up transfer of wealth, you know, from everyone to the, you know, fraction of 1%. And we don't know how that story will play out, but we sure know now from experience that if you leave huge numbers of people over decades with not enough working opportunities to pay their bills and a system that clearly isn't prioritizing their needs, they're ripe for right-wing opportunists who will demonize somebody, who will gin up some kind of fear. So I came to see this pattern again and again, writing about all these stories, and I realized that I had to go at the group that was actually responsible for this scarcity, and that's the billionaire class. And that's why I wrote this book.
And I'm glad you did. And Peter S. Goodman, I got to say, it sounds, if you haven't delved into it a little bit, that it could be very dry. You do it with a sense of humor, which is really appreciated when you're dealing with issues like this. I mean, you're talking about one of the most monumental heists in human history, and it's going on right under our noses. Can you talk about the man who founded this Davos World Economic Forum, Mr. Schwab, and how this all came about and why it happens?
Sure. Yeah. Klaus Schwab is a really interesting study. I mean, here's a guy who's trained as an economist. He grew up in Germany, in post-war Germany, kind of steeped in feelings of allegiance to the European Union, to the greater project of European collectivism. And then he goes off to the States and he takes management classes and he comes away with this idea that the solution to life's problems are, you know, business working hand in hand with government to come up with solutions. Now, you know, that sounds, if you live in a place like, say, a Nordic country, where business actually does have to deal with very powerful labor unions and a kind of collective understanding that workers have to be compensated so that they're getting the gains of productivity, you know, that kind of model makes a certain amount of sense. So Schwab throws the first of what later becomes the World Economic Forum, the seminar in the 1970s. He picks Davos, this kind of weirdly charmless village high up in the Alps in a valley that had at some point been used as a sanitarium for people suffering various diseases because the air is very clean. You're far away from everything else. And he gathers first a few hundred people, a bunch of economists, but then eventually it becomes heads of state. It becomes very prominent academics. Now, of course, there's movie stars, there's musicians. I mean, I once had dinner there with Peter Gabriel, who was showing me videos of himself, you know, making music with chimpanzees, I believe. I mean, it's become this stop for all powerful people. And along the way, Schwab has claimed that he's sort of staying true to the ideals while building it into a tremendously profitable business. I mean, it's officially a nonprofit, but Schwab has managed to get the forum to purchase a bunch of land that ties together this glittering headquarters on Lake Geneva in Geneva, Switzerland, next to his home in what's sort of known as the Beverly Hills of Geneva. He has elaborate dinners every night paid for by the forum. And over the years, he's actually tapped the forum as a kind of venture capital fund for profit-making ventures that then feed into a bunch of foundations he runs that have very little disclosure requirements under Swiss law. They're basically black boxes. At one point, he sent his nephew Hans off to Boston to run this video conferencing program in the 90s. He put $5 million of the fund's money in. And I talked to Hans Schwab at great length. You know, Hans said, well, you know, you're real happy with this. Oh yeah, I'm real happy. He launched an events business. So the forum was giving an exclusive contract to this events company that was for profit out of a nonprofit. Hans Schwab said, well, you know, I appreciate my involvement. Can I have a stake in this? And his uncle said, yeah, you can have 5%, but we're family, so we don't have to notarize this. Well, when that eventually gets sold to Publicis, this giant European advertising firm, Hans Schwab asks for his stake. And his uncle says, well, you know, that wouldn't look good. And he stiffs him, Schwab tells me. At the same time, the video conferencing software Hans Schwab sells to a dot-com company, this turns into a $20 million plus payout. And at the last minute, Klaus Schwab tells his nephew, you've got to change the paperwork so that all the shares are now owned by this new foundation for social entrepreneurship. And Hans Schwab says, you know, it's clear that his uncle had been spending time with Jeff Bezos, who at that time was a big draw at the forum. He'd been around all these people with money and he wanted some himself. And so all this money flows into the coffers of this new foundation. Nobody knows where it goes, but we do know that Klaus Schwab is living very, very large, and there's just no disclosure about where the money goes. So, you know, it's incredibly ironic. I mean, here's a guy who kind of lectures on corporate governance, and he's essentially running the forum, I say in the book, like a Chinese state-owned enterprise, where, you know, he has pieces of the action on the concessions for the World Economic Forum. This little village is mobbed by thousands of people. There are never enough hotel rooms. You can spend $400 a night to sleep in a dormitory where you're you're sharing a bathroom with 25 other people. This may go against the grain of the glamour that one imagines at Davos. And a lot of this money is going into Schwab's private coffers.
Wow. And keep in mind that most of the attendees, they don't fly in on commercial planes. There's a giant parking lot of private jets somewhere in Switzerland, right? I mean, it's any
helicopters. People show up with tans from St. Barts. You know, they've been on their yacht at St. Barts or the private islands of the Caribbean, and then they catch a jet to somewhere in Switzerland. Then they catch a helicopter up to this village. I mean, Schwab has spent his life successfully ingratiating himself with the wealthiest, most powerful people on earth, and along the way, he's clearly developed an appetite to get some of that.
So, in the book Davos Man, Peter Goodman, you do write about Schwab, but you also hone in on a few, you write five key specimens of Davos men.
Right.
Jeff Bezos, Jamie Dimon, those two we all know. The other ones are not as in your face. You have Mark Benioff of Silicon Valley, Stephen Schwarzman, chairman and CEO of the Blackstone Group, which is an asset manager, and Larry Fink, CEO of BlackRock, another asset manager. You know, the BlackRock and the Blackstone, it's like, to me, it's just noise. Who are these people and why should we know about them?
Well, Larry Fink is really an interesting character. I mean, Larry Fink is probably the most important person on earth who most people don't know anything about. Here's a guy whose company manages $10 trillion worth of wealth.
Wow.
I mean, he has hoovered up pension funds, university endowments, savings of extremely wealthy people. And he's invested it in just about everything there is to invest in. And he knows so much about the markets. And he's kind of a technological genius ahead of his time. You know, he designed a program called Aladdin that's now used by companies that collectively manage more than $20 trillion that scours portfolios around the globe looking for like little shifts that can indicate systemic trouble. So FINK is now so important that the U.S. government has not once but twice hired him to essentially manage their rescue response. I mean, after the great financial crisis, FINK's company was so insinuated in all the mortgage-backed securities and derivatives that it really knew more about the positions of, you know, Lehman Brothers, Washington Mutual, Merrill Lynch, you know, the whole host of institutions that were in trouble, such that, you know, everybody at the Fed, the Treasury Secretary, they wanted to know what Larry Fink knew because he was doing business with everybody. And of course, he used his access as a way to learn more about the operations of the Fed and the government. I mean, there are supposedly the term that gets thrown around is Chinese wall. You know, everyone says, oh, there's a Chinese wall between what BlackRock learns as a consultant to the government and what it uses in fashioning its advice for its clients. Yeah, okay. I mean, it turns out, as we've seen in the contracts for the most recent crisis, where during the pandemic, once again, FINK finds himself, you know, FINK's BlackRock finds himself managing the purchases by the Fed of a whole range of investments that have propped up asset prices for the wealthiest people on earth. And investors, they're not stupid. They can see, okay, FINK is going to decide where all this money goes. FINK happens to own, by dint of a very savvy purchase of so-called exchange-traded funds back during the last crisis, he owns iShares. These, you know, exchange-traded funds are like, they're like mutual funds made up of little pieces of lots of different investments, but they trade in real time.
Right.
So investors can see that, okay, FINK's going to decide to put some of the Fed's money into BlackRock's own ETFs. So investors jump out ahead. So those funds go up. Meanwhile, the contracts that we've seen around this advisory role show that after just a couple of weeks of so-called cooling off period, somebody working for BlackRock who's inside the Fed, understanding their models, understanding their view of the world, understanding what their strategy is going to be, they can then go back to the rest of BlackRock and just advise the company in its own advising of customers who are trading. So this is, you know, a gaping conflict of interest. FINK is a fascinating character because he has associated himself probably more than anybody else, except for maybe Benioff, with this concept of stakeholder capitalism. This now popular notion advanced by Davos men that, well, Milton Friedman, you know, the idea that we're just going to run our companies to maximize profits for shareholders, that's another era. In the new era, we understand that if we want to sustain our companies over the long haul, we got to think about stakeholders. We got to think about labor and local communities and societal interests. And so, you know, with much fanfare in the summer of 2019, the Business Roundtable, which was then headed by Jamie Dimon, the CEO of JPMorgan Chase, got 181 CEOs to sign this document saying that stakeholder capitalism is now how they run their companies. And a lot of credulous access journalists wrote this up as some sort of tremendous revolution, some, you know, great breakthrough. Larry Fink was right there, you know, at the front of the parade, along with Mark Benioff, the CEO of Salesforce, and Klaus Schwab, who had actually just written a book called Stakeholder Capitalism. And the pandemic was really the first test of these lofty principles. And let me tell you, the results are in. Like, somebody actually did an academic study that showed that companies that signed this Business Roundtable shareholder capitalism pledge were less likely to prioritize the health and welfare of their employees than just every other random company that trades on some public stock exchange. I mean, it's just very clear that this was just an elaborate exercise in PR. And in fact, the Business Roundtable set up a COVID-19 committee headed by the late CEO of Marriott, a guy named Arne Sorensen, who, you know, gave this video performance to his employees announcing that, oh, unfortunately, we're going to have to lay off 75% of the workforce, but I'm selflessly going to give up my salary in solidarity, which was about $1 million. He didn't say anything about his $8 million in stock-based compensation that one assumes he pocketed. And just a few weeks later, Marriott went out and spent, I believe it was I can't remember the number, but you know, some significant amount of money paying out dividends to its shareholders for that quarter. Wow. You know, money that could have kept a lot of hotel maids employed instead of unemployed and worrying about their health insurance in the middle of a pandemic.
And they could have used all those empty hotel rooms for good especially during the early days of the pandemic when, you know, healthcare workers didn't want to go home and infect their families. They could have used it for the greater good, but they didn't. Instead, these Davos men enriched themselves, right? They just, Jeff Bezos, Amazon became a necessity for so many people who wouldn't go out. And the wealth just kept compounding. And it seems like they did nothing to help the suffering of the millions of us who were just trying to make it from one day to the next.
Well, in the Marriott case, the most incredible thing, this was a real Davos man moment. They did eventually give up some of their hotel rooms to frontline medical workers. Nice. But in the beginning, they actually filled their social media feeds with pictures of their empty hotel rooms with the lights on, forming in geometrical patterns the shapes of hearts and letters spelling out hope. And, tweeted this stuff out like, look at us. This is us, you know, bolstering the spirit of the American public. You're welcome. You talk about Bezos, who famously sent out a letter during the first wave of the pandemic apologizing to his workers. This was after there was a full on labor uprising in Staten Island and others in sympathy. And the leader who I write about at length in my book, Christian Smalls, actually got fired for organizing, though they said he got fired for violating quarantine, which is incredible because he was actually trying to get paid sick leave, something that Amazon doesn't provide. Well, in the middle of this, Bezos, who also signed the Business Roundtable Stakeholder Capitalism Pledge, sends out this letter essentially saying, you know, dear Amazonians, we're so grateful for your sacrifice. It's true. It's very hard to get hand sanitizer and masks. We're working on it. I mean, this is the everything store, right? The everything store can't get enough stocks of this stuff. But still, you need to keep coming to work because you're essential workers and you're saving other people's grandmothers. You know, we're processing orders for hand sanitizer and gloves. So these guys are literally putting the same products that are denied them into boxes that they're sending off to paying customers. But it's worse than that. I mean, Christian Smalls told me that part wasn't even true. I mean, sure, there was some PPE going out the door, but he said it was the same crap, and he used more colorful language than that. It was usual. He said it was like, you know, video games, sex toys, you know, baking goods. I mean, the idea that they were somehow heroically saving the world and that's why Bezos was demanding the sacrifice was just absolutely cosmically untrue. And it was awfully hard for them to take.
Right. And with the billions he made, he built a penis-shaped rocket and launched himself into outer space. What else do you do as a billionaire?
And meanwhile, I mean, Larry Fink, back to BlackRock, was a particularly ripe example because, you know, he's pointing to the pandemic, cheerleading that the pandemic is the moment when we can all see that business is a force for good. And at the time, he is quietly behind the scenes leading a group of bondholders who are on the short end of bonds that they own in Argentina, where, you know, the healthcare system is inundated, where there's not enough finance because they're perpetually in crisis for food banks. I mean, there are legions of poor people unable to feed themselves in cities like Buenos Aires. And Fink is leading a team of bondholders demanding that the Argentine government pay up on these bonds at a time when the International Monetary Fund, which is not exactly known as like a softy, you know, friend of the everyman, is actually saying under Kristalina Georgieva publicly, actually, we got to think about debt sustainability. Like these, they can only go so far. And she's essentially nodding at other investors. If you push them too hard to agree to pay more than they can, we're just going to be back here cleaning up some debt mess again. So how about we cut them a break? Not out of charity, but out of fiscal prudence. And Fink at that point understands that Argentina is just the beginning of a whole series of debt workouts around the globe. And Fink is now sort of the victim of his own success, right? I mean, back in the old days, back in the 80s, if there was like a Mexico debt crisis, a bunch of bankers throwing these bonds would get in a room and they would say, all right, you know, how much of a haircut are we going to take? And they would emerge with a deal and we'd all go back to our lives. Well, Fink has been so successful in vacuuming up pension funds that he's in the position where he's going to have to go tell, you know, firefighters in Des Moines and public school teachers in Birmingham, England, hey, sorry, I lost all your money on Argentine debt. That's not very palatable. And he's going to have to go through the same thing on a series of emerging market bonds around the globe. So he's really playing hardball at the same time that he's publicly declaring business is the force for good. And of course, the loudest cheerleader of all is Mark Benioff, the CEO of Salesforce, who actually says at the forum last year, this can't be repeated enough, CEOs are the heroes of the pandemic. And he also says that it's this wonderful moment for us to all revel as one humanity, all singularly exposed to the virus. It erases the illusion of our borders. First of all, I should stop and tell you, Salesforce, apparently some Salesforce CEO tweeted at me the other day, actually has deals with ICE enforcing the very real borders for some people. But, you know, this idea, here's Benioff sitting in either his $28 million waterfront mansion in San Francisco or his oceanfront mansion in Hawaii on the Big Island, you know, waxing rhapsodically about how we're all unified while he's making more money than ever selling the software, allowing white collar professionals to work from anywhere while slaughterhouse workers are dying and told that they're, you know, essential workers, while people like Christian Smalls and other Amazon warehouse workers are told that they're essential workers and they have to sacrifice. I mean, it's pretty hard to take when you couple that with the fact that what all of these Davos men have in common is they have systematically and effectively lobbied for tax cuts that have limited the ability of states around the world to respond to the pandemic. So, you know, Benioff then tells us, well, thanks to my connections around the world, I'm able to get 50 million pieces of PPE out of China, and I can deliver them like Santa Claus to frontline medical workers around the country and, in fact, even around the world. Why are we dependent in the wealthiest, most powerful country on earth on the largesse of a software guy from Silicon Valley to outfit frontline medical workers in a pandemic? It's because of the pillaging beforehand that they get to take credit for being so generous with their crumbs in the middle of the pandemic.
The questions are just, I wish we had another hour because I could keep talking to you. Peter S. Goodman, the book is Davos Man. It is highly readable, and it's really important because we are suffering through this, the most unequal inequality, certainly in my lifetime. And it is, as this new Oxfam study says, it's killing people. And now with this pandemic, right, it is literally killing people all over the world. The insistence on keeping the patents on these vaccines is criminal. And the reason we keep getting all these new variants is because large portions of the world have no access to the vaccine. So the virus is going to keep morphing and making new variants and keep infecting us. There's no way out of it. If these people would stop maybe pocketing all the money and give some of it back, maybe things can get a little better. But it seems we're pretty far removed from that.
Yeah, no, that's right. I think you're right to put the focus on the vaccines. I mean, here's a case where with Pfizer and Moderna, you have publicly financed research. I mean, in Moderna's case, I think the U.S. government actually owns that IP. In Pfizer's case, you know, they used a lot of publicly financed research. And hey, thanks to them and their brilliant minds for coming out with these vaccines. It's absolutely right that we should be grateful for that. But, you know, we're treated as if we have to accept that we're going to pay through the nose for these vaccines. We're going to pay whatever they can get from the highest bidder and exclude the vast majority of humanity. And that we can either have that or we have no vaccines. I mean, what Davos Man is so skilled in is trading in these false binaries where it's like we're either living in a cave or we're in Venezuela rooting around in trash dumpsters for our dinner, or we accept the status quo in which Jeff Bezos and Pfizer, you know, get all our money. Well, I mean, come on. In this particular case, we have all effectively subsidized Pfizer's patent royalties through, you know, our closed schools, our disrupted airlines, our lives lost, the hunger around the world as billions of people are unable to go out and get sustenance. And this is all essentially because we've perpetuated this system where big pharma dictates the terms, the patents are somehow sacred. And the worst part of it all is that people in the developing world are essentially being told, you know, hey, we've got this. Like, we've got COVAX or some other, you know, stakeholder capitalism, like, you know, kind of charity, which has completely failed, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, we are living in a world now where you have frontline medical workers in Africa treating COVID patients without protection while we're debating, you know, whether to vaccinate five-year-olds in America. That's the world that we live in. And yet the people in the rest of the world are told, hey, you can count on us. Well, this pandemic has exposed, if it wasn't clear before, that you can't count on them. We can't count on the goodness of billionaires to save us. We need democracy. We need people to exercise their will through democracy so that we can get back to shaping a kind of economic system that's actually working for most people.
You know, someone in the chat, I caught it out of the corner of my eye, invoked a book that Ralph Nader wrote about a decade or so ago called Only the Super Rich Can Save Us. I guess he got it wrong.
Yeah. I mean, the super rich have got they a lot going for them.
They can save us. They just choose not to.
I mean, my intent is not to demonize business or even billionaires. I mean, I'm not sure we need billionaires. I'm not sure there's any system that would produce billionaires per se, but whatever. That's an academic debate. There's nothing wrong with rich people. There is something wrong with rich people who have systematically taken away returns for everyone else and have left everyone else effectively dependent on their charity just for their basic sustenance. That cannot sustain itself.
No, especially when they're not as charitable as they should be. Just start with paying their taxes. I'd be happy with that. Peter S. Goodman, the book is great. It's called Davos Man, How the Billionaires Devoured the World. It is out today. I can't thank you enough for being here. I wish we had more time because I could keep going. You're fascinating. The book is fascinating. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much for writing this.
Oh, I really enjoyed this. Thank you so much. Terrific. Nicole, take care.
Thank you. You take care too. Bye-bye. Peter S. Goodman, again, he's the writes economics for the New York Times and wrote this book. And and it's out today. I do know that he's going to be on Mehdi Hasan's show tonight. I saw him promote it yesterday. So, good stuff. All right. And with that, we are out of time. We're actually a little bit into overtime. You know, and the good thing about it is he's got a sense of humor about it. So enjoy it. I did. Okay, with that, we're done. Tomorrow, let me explain to you what's going to happen tomorrow. Tomorrow's Wednesday. An old friend of mine from back in my music days has a new book out. I'm not talking about the Betty White. This is a guy that I met. I think I met Tim Devine is his name when he came up to a radio station I worked at with Bonnie Raitt. He was an A&R guy. He's like dug in deep to the music industry. And over the past few years, I've noticed his online social media posts getting ever more political. And he's one of us. He's progressive like us. And he's got a new book out. And I don't have the title of it here. I've got the PDF, so I don't even have a hard copy of it. But it's about Trump. And the minute it was released, like just a few days ago, it shot up to number one on Amazon political books or something. Weird, right? So Tim's going to join us tomorrow. I'm going to find out why he would torture himself to write this book and why it took off the way it did. And we'll have a good wide-ranging conversation, I'm sure. It's been many years since I've spoken to Tim Devine. So we'll do that tomorrow. Thursday is Howie. Friday, there's a new movie coming out called Not Going Quietly that details Eddie Barkin's fight. You know, he's been this Medicare for All activist who's been battling ALS. And this movie, it's a documentary about him, which I haven't watched yet, but I'm going to like sometime before Friday because we're going to talk to the directors on Friday. All right. As always, thank you for listening. Thank you for being here. Couldn't do it without you. Oh, I forgot to show the Davos cartoons I had. I'll tell you what. While the news is playing, for those of you watching on video, I'll show the Davos cartoons. All right. I'll leave you with the news. I'll see you tomorrow. Thanks for listening, everyone. Have a good night.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
On this federal holiday that honors him, it's not just enough to praise him. We must commit to his unfinished work to deliver jobs and justice, to protect the sacred right to vote, the right from which all other rights flow.
President Biden repeating his call for Congress to pass voting rights legislation as the nation marked Martin Luther King Jr. Day. Today, Tuesday, the U.S. Senate takes up voting rights legislation. The Senate reconvenes at noon Eastern Time. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer will move forward with the motion to proceed to the voting rights package that just passed the House. It includes both the Freedom to Vote Act and the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act. Now, because the Senate Democrats are using a legislative strategy that involves a message which allows them to get around the Republicans filibustering opening the debate. Schumer promised a cloture vote on the package. Well, the earliest that would happen is Wednesday. And if that fails, which it will, then Schumer has vowed to hold a vote on changing the rules concerning the filibuster. Enter Manchinema. Yes, Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema have already announced that they will not agree to getting rid of the filibuster. But a quick note, Schumer could easily institute a change back to the talking filibuster all on his own. I don't know what he's waiting for. Stay tuned. In COVID news, Dr. Anthony Fauci on Monday said that it's too soon to tell whether the current Omicron wave would be the last surge of the coronavirus pandemic. Omicron has quickly become the dominant strain of the virus, and it's driven a record increase in new cases. But Omicron has caused less severe cases of COVID-19, fueling hopes and speculation that it could boost natural immunity and help bring the pandemic to an end. But Fauci, appearing via video conference at the Davos Agenda virtual event, said that it was still impossible to predict whether that would happen. Meanwhile, the cases keep piling up. General Mark Milley, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, tested positive. According to his spokesperson, is experiencing very minor symptoms. Milley has been vaccinated and boosted and had tested negative on several previous days. But he is now the latest of several top Defense Department officials to be infected this month as Omicron spreads quickly across the country. Milley is working remotely in isolation and performing his normal duties. Over at the Supreme Court, according to court sources, when the justices resumed in-person arguments last fall when cases were in a marked decline, Justice Sotomayor regularly wore a mask. She's the only one of the nine to do so, as she has diabetes. Well, now that Omicron is surging, Sotomayor didn't feel safe in close proximity to her unmasked colleagues. Apparently, Chief Justice John Roberts understood her concern and in some form asked the other justices to put on their masks too. Well, they all did, except for Neil Gorsuch, who sits next to Sotomayor on the bench. His continued refusal to wear a mask means that Justice Sotomayor is joining in the justices' weekly conferences by phone and hearing arguments remotely from her chambers. First Australia, now France. The French Sports Ministry said Monday that it would not grant any exemptions from a new vaccine pass law that received final approval on Sunday. The statement suggested that Serbian tennis star Novak Djokovic, who is not vaccinated, will likely also be prevented from participating in the French Open in May. Djokovic, who's ranked number one in the world and is chasing a record 21st Grand Slam title, was deported from Australia on Sunday, killing his hope of winning the Australian Open. And China announced on Monday that it was stopping ticket sales for the Beijing Winter Olympics just 2 days after the city's first case of Omicron. China said last fall it was barring foreign spectators. But on Monday, Beijing's Winter Olympics Organizing Committee said it wouldn't let domestic fans attend either. This in order to ensure the safety of all participants and spectators. Through her attorney, convicted sexual abuser Ghislaine Maxwell told a New York federal judge that she will no longer fight to keep secret the names of eight, count them, eight high-profile men connected to a 2015 defamation case brought by Virginia Jeffrey. She's one of Maxwell and Epstein's victims. Maxwell's now facing up to 65 years in prison after she was found guilty last month on five federal charges for her role in Jeffrey Epstein's sexual abuse of minor girls between 1994 and 2004. And finally, as the world's richest and most powerful gather virtually this year, thanks to COVID, at the Davos World Economic Forum, a new report released from Oxfam details how the wealth of billionaires increased more than ever over the past 2 years. The chief finding, the 10 richest people in the world, all white men, more than doubled their wealth from a collective $700 billion to $1.5 trillion. The organization estimated that over 160 million people were pushed into poverty at the same time. Peter S. Goodman, the author of the new book, Davos Man, How the Billionaires Devoured the World, is my special guest today on The Nicole Sandler Show. Heard on Progressive Voices at 5 Eastern, 2 Pacific, or podcast anytime from NicoleSandler.com. And you just heard Peter S. Goodman. I'm only breaking in here with some breaking news that happened during the show, but the Select House Committee investigating January 6th issued subpoenas today to Trump-allied attorneys Rudy Giuliani and Sidney Powell, along with Jenna Ellis and Boris Epstein. Couldn't happen to a nicer group. All right. See you tomorrow, everyone. Bye.